I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection. When Defense Secretary Donald Rumsfeld confirmed what many families had already suspected, his announcement of an extension of Iraqi service was still a blow to the parents, the spouses, and the children of soldiers who were preparing for a homecoming.
We regret having to extend those individuals. They had anticipated being in country something like up to 365 days. This will extend their time in Iraq somewhat. But the country is at war, and we need to do what is necessary to succeed.
Now, military families are advised to prepare themselves for such news. It's harder for those with someone in the reserves or the National Guard. Many of these people signed up to pay for college or make some pocket money. At worst, they thought they might be filling up sandbags for some nearby disaster relief. Now they're living behind those sandbags on the other side of the world with little to no relief. This hour, we're talking about those in the National Guard and the Reserves and focusing on how the staffing of this Iraq war is transforming the U.S. military. We'd like to have you join our conversation. Is it a good thing to have more of the Reserves and the Guard in active combat situations? Does it make the U.S. military a more effective force? Or is the military putting these men and women at risk by asking them to perform duties that they weren't expecting to perform? Our number is 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. And we're going to start our program today with the latest news from Iraq. During morning rush hour today in the southern city of Basra, a series of coordinated car bombs exploded in front of Iraqi police stations. There are reports that at least 68 people have been killed in the bombings. Anne Bernard's a correspondent with the Boston Globe, and she's joining us now live from Baghdad. Hello, Anne.
Hi, Dick. How are you?
Well, I'm fine. I'm interested in the latest news from Basra. What are you hearing?
Well, apparently the attacks were quite coordinated. There were three explosions that went off at three different police stations in Basra and another in Suwayr, which is southwest of Basra. And it was quite shattering to hear this news this morning because people around Baghdad had been noting that suddenly it had seemed relatively quiet after two and a half weeks of renewed fighting. Yesterday, people thought there was a truce in Fallujah. Nothing very upsetting happened in Baghdad. Then overnight, we had the attack on Abu Ghraib prison in Baghdad and woke up to the news of these bombings.
And we're also getting some reports, a little bit sketchy at this point, and that there has been shooting in Fallujah. Is the ceasefire there broken down?
Well, that's what we're hearing. Again, the reports are kind of sketchy. The wires are reporting that residents say six civilians were killed. I was at the Ministry of Health this morning. They had not had any new reports overnight out of Fallujah, but those usually take a while to catch up.
Now, Anne, we're going to be concentrating this hour on reserves and National Guard, in part looking at the way that the U.S. military is being transformed by this war. I know you've had some opportunity to speak with soldiers, active duty and otherwise, in the Baghdad area. Tell me how they have been taking news of the extension of their deployment and how their morale is holding up.
Well, I have to tell you, about a month ago when I was interviewing soldiers who had already been here for almost a year, they were scheduled to go home in a few weeks, but they were very superstitious about talking about that. I think they had a feeling that anything could happen. They, at the time, were pretty satisfied looking back on the year, some frustrations, some sense of accomplishment. Some were even wistful about leaving behind some Iraqis that they had worked closely with. And then immediately after that, you had the renewed fighting in Fallujah, the fighting with Sadr's militia. People started to realize that they might end up staying. And then I got some emails from those guys before the official announcement saying, guess what, we're staying for another 3 months. So they were resigned. They were mostly upset that they had to break the news to their families.
Yeah, and there was considerable coverage here in America about people who were anticipating the return and then found out that it was going to be delayed. Anne, thanks for being with us on the program today. You take care.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Anne Bernard is a correspondent with the Boston Globe. Brigadier General Mark Hertling is on the line with us. He's with the 1st Armored Division based in Baghdad, and he's joining us on the line from there. Brigadier General, hello.
Hello, Dick. How are you today?
I'm fine. Thanks for being with us. I understand that you've been on the road lately, traveling from Baghdad to Germany and back again. In fact, talking with a number of the military families who are hearing news of an extended deployment. Is that right?
That's exactly right. General Dempsey, our division commander, and I talked last Thursday and thought it important for their leadership to go back and talk to the families. The majority of families of our division are in Germany, and tell them actually what was going on, break the news to them officially in conjunction with the notification by the Department of Defense. So I went back last Thursday night, spent the weekend through Monday talking to our different communities throughout Germany and telling them what was going on, what was happening, and then flew back last night about 4 this morning.
What kind of feedback were you getting?
It was, well, of course, everyone's disappointed about this.
I think we're losing our line to Baghdad. General Hertling, can you hear me?
Can you still hear me, Dick? I'm sorry.
Yeah, you're back now. Go ahead. You said that you said there was a mixed response.
Well, and not so much. Everyone was initially disappointed at the news. But frankly, after understanding what was going on, and that was critical and why we went back or why I went back to talk to the spouses, after understanding what was happening here, what we were doing about it, what we were being asked to do as part of the military, I think the great majority of the spouses, while still being disappointed that their loved ones weren't coming home when they expected, understood and are very supportive. In fact, they are the true heroes of this deployment. They are very supportive of their soldiers and understand the mission, and this is what we do.
Brigadier General, we're going to be talking through the hour about reservists and National Guard people who are serving in Iraq,
right,
and how their presence there is changing the military. Are you seeing them in a way becoming more a part of the active duty force in the way that that they've been integrated into this particular exercise in Iraq?
Well, I think over the last several years, we've seen a growing consolidation between the reserve and the active component. And the 1st Army Division, we at one time had a force of about 37,000 soldiers here in Baghdad. It's declined to about 28 or 29,000. About 20% of our force were reserve component forces, either National Guard or reserve. And they were certainly a force multiplier. They were a great part of our force. In fact, in many instances, other than the patch that the units wore, you couldn't tell the difference if it was a Georgian National Guard unit or a Maine Reserve unit or an active component unit from Germany or the United States.
And could you put your finger on the one thing that you think then changes the forces by having such a high component of reservists and National Guardsmen there? Is it age? Is it experience? What does the U.S. military gain?
Well, I think it contributes to having the will of the people whenever you go into a conflict. It's one thing to have a volunteer force where people say, hey, I do this. They sometimes become separated from the entire population at large. But if you have, you know, because they're holed up in bases and places like Fort Benning or Fort Bragg, whereas if you have someone who's your next-door neighbor who suddenly is mobilized, that brings a conflict home and makes it important to the American people. And that was the whole reason for the specific jobs within the reserve component being supportive of the active duty as we went. That was the whole concept behind it. Now, that's changing, and I know Secretary Rumsfeld wants that to change and be a little bit more specific, but that's really what they contribute. They become part of the team, and we have to have them, and they have to have us to fight these wars right now.
Mark, again, thanks for being with us on the program. Brigadier General Mark Hertling of the 1st Armored Division in Iraq. They're live on the line from Baghdad. I'm going to go to the man who will be seeing us through our hour on this program. Richard Cohn is professor of history at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill and co-editor of Soldiers and Civilians, The Civil-Military Gap in American National Security. Mr. Cohn, thanks a lot for coming onto the program.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
You've had a chance to listen in to what the Brigadier General was talking about, and I guess this is in principle what you're looking at, how the U.S. military is being changed by the increased responsibility of both the reservist and the National Guard.
That's exactly right. What the general was saying, interestingly enough, he didn't answer your question on the subject of is this good for the military. He was saying essentially that this was political, that the purpose of having these reservists and guards people with the regulars was to mobilize the nation. And that is indeed why the country adopted the total force policy in the early 1970s in reaction to Vietnam, because we hadn't called up the reserves and guard in Vietnam. It's really a belief on the part of the regular military that they need the country behind them, and this is one way to make it happen. But of course, with the changes in the 1990s, the beginning of the use of guard and reserves on a continual basis for peacekeeping and stability operations and low-level continuous combat problems, it has changed the role. They're no longer an emergency force that's going to be suddenly mobilized for a big war and then go home. They're going to be used constantly. Of course, like the Air National Guard has always been used over the last 30-plus years on a regular supplementary basis to the U.S. Air Force. But this is now extending to the ground troops, too. And I think we really have a new military establishment that we haven't really designed as such. It's really regulars, part-time regulars, which is what the Guard and Reserve have become, and of course contractors, which has been very much in the news in our forces in Iraq.
When we look back at history, the reservists, the Guard, were they meant to be involved in this type of conflict?
No, they weren't, Dick. The concept of the Guard that goes all the way back to the colonial militia was that they would be combat forces temporarily called into service in an emergency, not used in a kind of a constabulary way on a continual basis for what really is the classic mission of regular forces.
But isn't it up to the president to define what an emergency is?
Well, that's right. But if you're having continual emergencies since the mid-1990s, even
right.
before the War on Terror, you begin to wonder what just emergency means.
And the reservists also not traditionally part of an overseas fighting force.
That's right, and not part of an overseas fighting force that is doing peacekeeping, stability kinds of peace enforcement operations. They go over to fight and they come home. Of course, under this total force policy in the last 30 years, we have placed into the reserve and guard the kinds of support units that the military, the regular military, couldn't afford to keep up. For example, a lot of military police, a lot of civil affairs units simply migrated out of the regulars, particularly in the ground forces, and into the reserves because that was a good place to keep them. You wouldn't use them very often, and it left the regulars with much more combat power. And, of course, Congress always wants much more tooth to tail in designing the regular military.
We have to take a short break, so a reminder that our telephone number is 1-800-423-8255. We're talking about the large number of reservists and National Guard serving in Iraq. Is this, in fact, what they signed up for? If they signed up 4 or 5 years ago for a 6-year commitment, was this in their mind, or was this always something in the fine print that they had to be aware of? How is it changing the way this country understands its military force? 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection from NPR. I'm Dick Gordon. You're listening to The Connection from National Public Radio. We're talking about the large number of reservists and National Guard serving in Iraq. Their participation there brought once again into fairly sharp focus last week when Secretary of Defense Donald Rumsfeld announced that their terms there, their time there, was going to be extended because of the increased insurgency in Iraq. Richard Cohn is with us on the program here. He knows his uniforms well. He's former chief historian of the U.S. Air Force and is currently a professor of history at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. Richard, just to sort of finish off this way that we understand how their participation in the war has or is in a way changing the military. Do you see it as something which is being done in an active or a passive way, that the Pentagon is saying, yes, politically we want to use them, they are going to provide the public connection to the war that General Hertling was talking about, or do you see their participation there changing simply because bodies are needed, and they're sending those people over to Iraq.
Well, I think it's a bit of both, but I think it's much more the latter, because we simply don't have, particularly in our ground forces, enough ground forces to fulfill our worldwide commitments and have a 100,000-plus people in Iraq on an indefinite basis. It's particularly a problem because we have to spread the obligation and the duty and the danger. You can't keep people there indefinitely. Since the Korean War, we've practiced a year in a combat zone, and that's it. So you have to rotate the forces, and the Army simply is not sized to be able to go through the kinds of rotations that the Navy, for the course of the Cold War, was organized to do, and then the Air Force switched to doing in the 1990s. So I think it's more the problem of enough people. And quite frankly, and I, even the Secretary of Defense admitted this last week, they've been surprised by the extent to which they need forces and the amount of resistance and conflict that's going on in Iraq.
Let's hear from Captain Winfield Danielson. He's joining us on the line now from Milford, Massachusetts. He works as media officer for the Massachusetts National Guard. Captain Danielson, thanks for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
Tell me, in your view, how you're seeing this switch come about. You're at the recruiting end here. What's happening there?
Well, first of all, looking at it as a switch, it depends on your historical perspective. I think recently, over the last 50 years or so, this is kind of a new thing. But if you look at it over the long term, I don't think that the Guard playing a larger role is really that new. First of all, the National Guard, being a descendant of the colonial militia, is the only constitutionally established armed force for the country. And I think the Founding Fathers intended for them to be used for conflicts, because committing those citizen soldiers to battle is something that a government isn't likely to do lightly. And they have indeed been part of an overseas fighting force. World War I, World War II, Korea, National Guard soldiers and airmen played a central role in all of those conflicts.
But less so in Vietnam.
Less so in Vietnam, but it isn't just major conflicts. I mean, even if you look at historically at lower-level conflicts like the Mexican-American War,
yeah,
the Spanish-American War, and the Mexican Border Campaign, the Guard has historically participated in lower-level conflicts as well. But you're right. When you get to Vietnam, when you're in the middle of the Cold War, you do see a reduced role for the National Guard because you have a larger active component.
Duty force, yeah.
At the end of the Cold War, when we had the peace dividend, and we drew down the active component, obviously we saw a return to really the Guard's historical role as a central component of the total force package.
And what's happening at the recruiting end? Are you keeping your numbers up as this war goes on?
Well, currently this year is looking good. Fiscal year 2003, we our recruiting numbers in Massachusetts were down by roughly a third. And in fiscal year 2004, the current year, so far they're up again by about a quarter. So it's remaining relatively stable. Our retention rates for the units that have come back, for the most part, have been consistent with our retention rates prior to deployment. Some units have taken a hit, some haven't. But so far, it doesn't look like it's having the conflict itself is having a large impact on our recruiting and retention.
Richard Cohen, it's been your observation that in the years ahead, though, this may change as people who have looked at the reserve as perhaps less an exercise that was going to take someone overseas will think twice about that commitment.
Well, my friends in the Guard and Reserve are watching it very closely, Dick, trying to see what the impact will be of these deployments. You're likely to get a different sort of person into the Guard and Reserve if they know that 1 year out of five or 1 year out of six they are actually going to be deployed and have to leave their civilian job. It's a problem with employers. For people who are self-employed, who have businesses, for professionals, a doctor, a lawyer's practice, a clergyman with a congregation, it's a real problem. And so it's liable to change the demography or at least the sociology of the Guard and Reserves. And that's a problem. But I have to say, too, in response to what the captain said, he's unfortunately got it kind of exactly wrong in terms of the history. When you look back at the 19th century, that was a different era. We didn't have a large worldwide military, regular military establishment. The real historical template to judge what's going on against is the Cold War since about 1950, and not Korea and Vietnam, which were huge expansion emergencies, but the kind of 1990s, 1980s, 70s in the use of the Guard and Reserves. And quite frankly, it's very different if you look at simply the numbers of man or person days on active duty of the Guard and Reserves. It jumped dramatically in the 1990s from about 1 million a year to 13 million a year. And I don't think it's gone down at all, probably up.
All right, well, let's hear from some of our listeners. Our number is 1-800-423-8255. Do we look at this just in the last 20, 30 years, sort of within our own experience and lifetime, or in longer terms? Let's hear from Valerie. Valerie's in Buffalo, New York. Hi, Valerie. Thanks for calling.
Hello. Thank you for having me.
How do you look at this?
Well, I am a Naval Reserve officer, and I volunteered for the Gulf War. Unfortunately, I was not taken. But I find it disgusting and reprehensible when people sign up for the reserves and take government money for however long and then are surprised and afraid and try to worm out of serving their country when they're called to duty.
Is that what you're seeing, Valerie?
I have seen that, yes.
And do you think for those people who might have looked at it as, you know, occasional weekends, or rather weekend duty and a week or so in the year, that they were deluding themselves, trying to pretend that it wasn't a serious commitment?
Very much so. It's not for them, for their convenience. It's for the defense of our country.
Do you think that this war will change that attitude?
I think that those who join in order to help themselves out financially will be more reluctant to join. But I also think that everybody should have to serve in the military as some of the European countries do.
Mm-hmm. Okay, well, thanks for your call. I want to go straight, if I can, across to another person who's on the line. Paul Vogel is joining us. He is the father of the Army Reservist Aaron Vogel, 652nd Engineer Company. And Paul, thanks for being with us. I understand Aaron is home now. Is that right?
Correct. Yeah, he's home as of 2 weeks ago from Iraq.
And I know that you have been sort of speaking out against the war itself, but if I bring you to the point where we are on where the reserves and the National Guard ought to be used, where would you come down? Do you think that Aaron falls into the category of the person that Valerie's describing, someone who signed up, wanted to get, you know, a little bit of exposure, but never really expected combat?
I think he believed that the contract that he signed would definitely be upheld. As most people know, a contract is a two-sided deal, and he believed at the time when he signed up in the year 2000 that not so much for the money, but for the idea of pursuing a challenging opportunity which the Army Reserve presented to him. I think he believed that he would definitely be at risk, but at the same time, under the year 2000 leadership administration, wasn't looking at a conflict that would put he and his whole unit over in Iraq within a matter of months.
So you would say that the current administration, in a way, changed the rules during the course of Aaron's contract with the reserves, right?
Oh, absolutely. And certainly we all understand 9/11 changed a lot of things, but this, as the professor talks about, the transformation of the reserves into a component of the full-time army really is not being clearly defined and nor clearly spelled out enough that parents and families can make a proper decision as to what they really want to commit.
Paul, what happened with Aaron when he went to Iraq? He was going over there to fix bridges, right?
Well, he's his engineering company, the 652nd, is a bridge company that builds bridges, the floating type.
Right.
And they were deployed to the Bakuba, Iraq area, and they were actually involved with very briefly with one bridge, but 99% of their time was spent either infantry type duties or actually guarding duties of different compounds over there in Bakuba.
And if you were to sort of make one specific point, Paul, about how you think this contract, either written or understood contract, between reservists and National Guard and the U.S. military needs to change to reflect the current reality, what would you say needs to change?
Well, I think it needs to be spelled out that we are, as the American people, are treating our reservists as full-time Army. And then when a recruiter steps forward and says to a young man coming out of the high school who's looking for money to get into college in some way, they have to be very clear about what the cost could potentially be as far as time and their family's lives and the others. So I think, as the professor pointed out, it'll change the reserve component, and I just think the government and the Army needs to be upfront about that.
Paul, thanks for being with us on the program.
Thank you.
Paul Vogel is father of the Army reservist Aaron Vogel of the 652nd Engineer Company, joining us there from Fort Lauderdale. And Richard, I want to come back to you if I can. I know that there have been many politicians in Washington making the same point. You're going to ask these folks to serve in a more forward capacity. You got to change the rules for medical insurance, for child tax credits, for compensation. Is that a part of the change that still has to take place?
I think it does. I think there has to be a better system for integrating people, too, in the personnel systems between the Guard, the Reserve, and the regulars, and benefits and VA eligibility and all the rest of it. But a larger question that's more on people's minds, I think, is just what is the nature of the commitment and how these forces in the Reserve and Guard are going to be used.
Mm-hmm.
The present people in the Guard and Reserve, those mobilized, contrary to what Paul and Valerie said, I think these are very patriotic people. And yes, they're surprised, and I think their families may be to some degree more upset than they are. They signed on. Of course, they were recruited with this economic incentive. We shouldn't forget that. But they're patriotic people. They are very highly trained. They're quite professionalized. And it's just not part of their ethic, I think, to complain about this openly or to grumble about it. Grousing is an old American military tradition, but with the people of this degree of commitment, I think we're not seeing across the whole force a great deal of grumbling. I hear that morale's pretty high, both over there and the people coming back.
Captain Danielson, there are going to be parents listening to our conversation this morning who, you know, might have an 18, 19, 20-year-old at home. And I can imagine their conversation with their son or daughter being different as a result of 9/11, as a result of the war in Iraq, not to sort of go too far back into the politics of how we got to where we are today. But Junior's going to say, look, I'm interested in the Guard. I'm interested in the reserves. And the mother and the father's going to say, it's different now. You realize that you're going to make that commitment, and it's not the same thing that happened with your older cousin or your older brother who did their 4 years, did their 6 years, went through university. And I'm wondering, from your perspective, sitting behind the desk that you occupy, would you encourage this type of conversation so people perhaps have a different idea about the kind of commitment they're making?
Well, I would encourage any conversation. I mean, we want people, when they join the Guard, to know what they're getting into because we want people simply that want to be here. And I think that's what we have. Mm-hmm. Most people that join the Guard, I think, join because they want to give something back to their country. As was stated earlier, they're patriotic people. I mean, yes, they do get paid. Yes, they do get educational incentives, but those are available elsewhere. So, you know, there must be another reason why they come. And the rules haven't changed. Title 10 of the U.S. Code allows for mobilization during presidential emergency for up to 24 consecutive months. So the 6 months and you know, 1 year boots on the ground policies that were put out by the DOD, those were policies that were put out by the Department of Defense. But under presidential authority, they could be called up to 24 consecutive months. So the rule, according to Title 10, hasn't changed. But in fairness, like I said, it's been a long time since the Guard has been used in that way. So, you know, people aren't used to it. So, yes, your experience, if you're coming in today, may be different than your cousin's or your father's, but it may not be that different than your grandfather's.
Okay, let's hear from Chris Munson. Chris has been listening in on the line. His wife, Felice Munson, is a staff sergeant with the 737th Transportation Army Reserves, and Chris is on the line from Toppenish, Washington. Hi, Chris.
Hello.
How's Felice doing?
Fine. She's doing good over there.
Now, she's been in Kuwait now for, what, 3-4 months?
Yep.
And how...
Three.
I'm sorry, go ahead.
About three.
And what's the work that she's doing?
They are transportation. Their main mission is hauling fuel.
Chris, Felice has been in the reserve now for almost 20 years. Was she surprised to get the call up?
No, actually, we've been together 11 years, and this is the fourth time that it's been she's had a call. This is the first time she's gone. I kind of disagree with the fact that, people are saying, well, we had no idea we were able to be called because, I mean, her and their unit, I mean, they are totally upfront about, hey, you could be called to go at a moment's notice.
So when you hear people who are talking about, holy smokes, I didn't expect this to happen when I signed up, what do you say to them?
You could get called at any time. And, I mean, like I said, their unit, her, when she talks to new recruits, it's up front. But, yeah, you could get called to go at any time. And, like I said, this is the fourth time. This is the first time she's actually had to go. But
Chris, you got two kids at home. How are they taking it?
Well, actually, I mean, they've been prepared. They've known that this could happen. Daughter, she's only 5, so it's not so much that she knew, but the son, he's known. And the daughter's handling it like a little trooper. So.
And you too, I hope.
Oh, yeah, it was a little touch and go on the emotional side, even though I'm a guy, you know, at the beginning. And I think the worst part, you know, being left home is not knowing what's going on.
Chris, I got to let you go. I want to thank you for being with us, and please pass our best regards on to Felice Munson, Staff Sergeant, over in Kuwait. We're continuing the conversation about reserves after the break. I'm Dick Gordon. You're listening to The Connection from National Public Radio. Does it make the U.S. military a more effective fighting force when more of the reserves and the National Guard are integrated in active combat situations? Certainly that is a change in modern history that we're watching take place in Iraq as we speak. And we'd like to have you in on our conversation. We're at 1-800-423-8255. We're going to go to Providence, Rhode Island. Mark's joining us on the line. Mark, thanks for calling.
Yes, good morning, Dick.
Tell me your perspective here.
I agree 100% that the military does benefit from having civilians mobilized as reservists in the military. I'm a civil affairs officer, just got back from a tour of Iraq, and our contribution there, we provide things that the active duty military can't. We have specialists that are policemen, that are public utilities workers, and myself, a history professor, we can bring things to the situation that the active duty just doesn't.
And if we look at this, Mark, as something of a more permanent change in the way that the military is deployed, would you be one of the ones standing up and saying, proper thing, that's exactly what we need, is that mix of civilian experience along with the active duty soldiers?
Oh, I agree 100%. We need that mix. We also need to be able to fund it and field it properly, and that's where we need to work right now. We need to get some more of these specialties in the civilian side, in the reserves, and focus on getting them beefed up so that we're not deploying the same batch of people every single time.
Okay, but make the case for me, Mark, because we were listening to the story of Aaron Bogle, who went quite happily over to Iraq with the idea that he'd be putting Bailey bridges across rivers and found himself toting a gun around for the next 10, 11 months. You are a specialist in civil affairs. Were you able to use that despite the fact that it wasn't quite the nation-building peacekeeping exercise that everybody was imagining a year ago?
Oh, that's all we did was civil affairs. We were stretched out. We were overtaxed in that regard. And I did see a lot of other specialties that weren't doing. I saw artillerymen that were manning checkpoints. I saw engineers that were doing everything but engineering duty. So, again, we need to tailor the force and deploy that type of force. And right now, we need to look at the way the force is structured and then restructured to meet these needs. And especially from the reserve side, we're pulling up a lot of guys, engineers, and sending them over there, and they're not doing engineer duty. Then we need to look at training them in other specialties, for example, maybe in civil affairs, expanding the civil affairs, expanding the MP reserve units, and then sending them over that.
You're talking about more bodies, Mark. That's what you're talking about.
More bodies, but not necessarily more bodies, but properly trained in those tasks. Why am I going to send an engineer or an artilleryman to do what's ostensibly a civil affairs or an MP's mission? We need to focus and tailor the force so that what we deploy are what we need. Boots on the ground is one thing, but they got to be the right boots in the right place at the right time.
Good point. Thanks for calling. Richard Cohn, tell me how you make the sort of adjustment so the point that Mark is making can actually work in a place like Iraq.
Mark makes excellent points. What he's really saying is that you need the National Guard to be rethought, reconceptualized. What's not been mentioned, Dick, is the whole role of the National Guard in Homeland Defense. We have great needs in Homeland Defense of a military and semi-military character, but many in the Guard don't want to be transformed into Homeland Police. The Secretary of Defense a year ago ordered a complete kind of review of the roles, missions, and organization of the National Guard. We've not heard about that in the last year. We don't even know what the process is or whether there is a process to reconceptualize this.
We're working on
and
it
I
now.
Think,
Winfield Danielson, what are you saying here?
What I'm saying is that he did indeed make that announcement, and the National Guard itself has actually made announcements on our transformation efforts.
Can you give me an example of what you mean?
Yeah, yes, what are they?
As a matter of fact. Well, we looked at it, and what we want to do is preserve the dual mission. We do have a dual mission both to support federal operations overseas as well as the Homeland Defense aspect. And to do that, we need to ensure that in the Guard we have relevant capabilities, relevant units that are more likely to be used in the changing nature of conflict at home and abroad that we have now. Military police, security forces, information operations, intelligence units. We need to rebalance and have some of these high demand units added, and some of the units that are not in as high demand, the numbers of those units reduced so that we can, so that our force mix is more relevant to the current situation. And that transformation is underway. The National Guard Bureau has put out several news releases on that.
But are you saying that if I'm a computer technician and I come to your office and I say, look, I've got all these skills, and under these circumstances, I'd be proud to serve overseas. Under these circumstances, I'd sooner do homeland security. Where can you put me so my skills will best be used? Because Mark's describing a situation where the guy with the computer skills is being handed an M16.
Right. Well, what he was talking about was there was a guy, I believe he was an engineer, who was going to be, his unit's mission was building bridges, who was doing security forces work. And the reason for that is there just simply aren't enough military police and security forces in either the active component or the National Guard to go around. Now, when a civilian wants to join the National Guard, certainly we take their civilian skills into account, and if we have a unit that caters to those skills, yes, we'll try to put them into that unit. But to try to make sure that they do the missions that they are trained for, we need to make sure we have the types of units to do those missions.
And Richard, what you're saying is that this requires a kind of rethinking that we haven't seen in practice, despite what Winfield says about
right.
it happening sort of at the ground level.
Yes, you can't do it in a reactive, piecemeal way, and that's what's going on. You've got to remember that these units are locally based units that when they're not on active duty, are people living in a community.
Right.
How do you tailor these specialized kinds of units around the country, both to meet, as the captain says, the dual need missions, match the skills of the people who want to serve? It's a very complicated algorithm. And it can't be done just on a piecemeal basis on the fly because we've got to beef up this force in Iraq that we didn't expect to have because we didn't plan for the aftermath. We're making do in a very fine way, but we really have to understand what it is that's going on here. The active
Let me stop you there if I can, because we've a number of calls that I want to make sure we get to before the program concludes. To Panama City, Florida now, and Phil's joining us. Hi, Phil. Thanks for your call.
Hey, how are you? Thanks for taking my call.
Yeah. What are you thinking?
Well, I spent 24 years in the North Carolina Army National Guard before retiring, and my National Guard unit was called to support Operation Desert Shield, Desert Storm. And in listening to your broadcast, I certainly agree with a professor at UNC. I'm not sure that the National Guard is being used in its most proper way. My understanding was that the Guard was intended to be used in time of a national emergency, at home or abroad. And I'm not real sure that this constitutes a national emergency.
Would you like to see the rules changed? Would you let your son join the National Guard the way it's set up now? What do you think?
Well, my son has recently indicated an interest in joining the National Guard, and even though I spent a career in the Guard, I've discouraged him. I would prefer he not.
What did you tell him?
Well, I just told him that I didn't think it was a proper thing for him to do, and that he may very well find himself in a situation where he's more of an active duty soldier than a reservist that would be called in time of a national need.
And Phil, if you were to change one thing to make it a better force, the National Guard better, what would you change?
Well, I think what I'd do is place more emphasis on keeping a larger standing active duty component, and I'd place the National Guard in more of its traditional role.
Domestically based.
And if there's a war that does indeed pose a national threat to our security, a threat to our national security, then obviously use the National Guard and the Reserve in those circumstances. But to use it just as as part of a force that's going to be deployed, as a normal routine, no, I don't think that's the intent.
Phil, thanks for your call. Captain Danielson, a reaction from you.
I think we're in an emergency. We're at war. I don't know how much more of a national emergency we can have than being at war. I think it's a good thing that, it's hard to send National Guard and Reserve overseas to conflicts because they are members of the community. It's hard on families. It's hard on employers. And that's a good thing because that makes people think twice before they commit armed forces for overseas duty. It's not an easy decision to make, and it shouldn't be. And as to the piecemeal comment earlier about the transformation, I would disagree that it's piecemeal. Now, certainly, we are operating at a very high operations tempo, but General Blum at the Guard Bureau is doing a deliberate review of our forces mix and our capabilities, and they are going to do a transformation that is planned and deliberate. It's not piecemeal.
Okay, Captain, I just want to stop you there for half a second. I want to take one more call. This is from Fort Bragg, North Carolina. Jess is on the line. Hi, Jess. Thanks for calling.
Thank you. I just wanted to say that I don't know who your guests are talking to or where they're getting their statistics from, but anecdotally, everybody I've spoken to who's came back from Iraq and Afghanistan over the past year, retention outlook is really pretty horrible on the active and the reserve side, both of which I've spoken to.
Are you a reserve or active duty or National Guard, Jess?
I'm active duty.
And you're saying people don't want to re-enlist?
Well, yeah. I know people, reserve units, who've pretty much done back-to-back deployments over the past couple of 3 years, not 3 years, but since 9/11 kicked off, they'd go down, come back Afghanistan, they came back, turned around, and went right back to Iraq. You know what I mean?
And is it fair to say, Jess, that the strain is greater on the reservists and the National Guard?
That could go either way, really, because, I mean, it depends on what kind of people you're talking about, whether you're talking about a civil affairs unit out of the East or a ranger unit.
Yeah, I got you.
I mean, an active ranger unit, those guys have a very high op tempo, and their retention is really, I mean, quite bleak. Those guys don't want to stick around for that anymore. They shouldn't have to if they don't want to.
Jess, thanks for your call. I have to stop you there because I do want to get a final comment from Richard Cohn at UNC. Richard, the when and the how to use the Guard, this, whether you like it or not, it ends up being quite a political conversation, doesn't it?
Well, it has to be because we are talking about the policies of the United States, the defense of the United States, the involvement of the citizenry, and in some respects, the very core of our national existence.
So can the rules themselves be retooled to manage all the different sorts of conflicts that might come up next year, 10 years from now, so people have a better way of expecting what exactly their involvement would be?
I don't think the rules need to be changed. They've always been flexible and permitted us to call people up for periods of time, and it's very obvious that you might be called up. What really needs to change is the expectations and the understanding of what we're going to use these forces for. It's one thing to be called up for 30 days, 60 days, even to be sent overseas for 90 days. It's another thing to be called up and deployed for an entire year and to be put into a combat zone for an entire year. That's the big change, Dick, and I think that that has to kind of reverberate through the planning, the conceptualization, and the entire military strategy, not only of the Guard and Reserves, but of the entire military establishment.
Richard, I want to thank you for being with us on the program today.
Thank you.
Richard Cohn is a professor of history at the University of North Carolina, co-editor of Soldiers and Civilians, The Civil-Military Gap in American National Security. And Captain Winfield Danielson, I want to thank you for being with us as well.
Thank you for having me.
Captain Danielson is press officer for the Massachusetts National Guard. Earlier in the program, we talked with Brigadier General Mark Hertling with the 1st Armored Division in Iraq, and Barnard, a reporter for the Boston Globe based in Baghdad. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection.